What does it mean to be humbled? Perhaps it's to lose some pride, to feel less important, even a little defeated. From the Latin humus, soil, to be brought down to earth, to bite the dust, to be laid low. In that sense, maybe a humbling can never actually be welcomed in as great. We would never wish for this encounter with mortality on a planetary scale, but here we are. If this is a humbling, then maybe it's about a regrounding, a reconnection in which we are being made to stare into the dark mirror and reflect on the reflection we see staring back at us. Perhaps there's a message in that image. My name's Ed Gillespie, and myself and my co-host Dougald Hine have spent the last 20 years trying to decipher and articulate that message. How will they look in hindsight, these strange times we are living through? Is this a midlife crisis on humanity's road to the Star Trek future, or the point at which that story of the future unraveled and we came to see how much it had left out? What if our current crises are neither an obstacle to be overcome, nor the end of the world, but a necessary humbling? In the early weeks of the coronavirus crisis and the extraordinary rupture of the everyday that it represents, we set out to explore what it means to be humbled.
Ed, here we are. It's episode 7 of The Great Humbling. We kind of missed a week last week, but this feels like a good moment to reconvene for a conversation that we've given the title, The Cultivation of Conspiracy. So I suppose we ought to say at the start that we've not disappeared down the plandemic rabbit hole, but it's there in the mix. But meanwhile, before we get onto that, Ed, what have you been reading that's been getting you thinking this week?
Well, it's a bit of reading and it's a bit of attending. So, I mean, I attended an event, a nice Zoom conversation as part of the Living Room Sessions with the House of Beautiful Business, which is an event and a movement, sort of business romantic movement I've been involved with for about a year and a half now. And they've just postponed their autumn event, which was going to be called The Great Wave, rather presciently. And when you're hit by a great wave, you know, you have a number of different options. You're either washed away by it, inundated by it, or you manage to surrender to it and swim with it. And it was a wonderful event they did where they had the guy Jonathan Locke, who was talking about the disruption of space-time in this strange period. And he was very beautifully describing the fact that a lot of our perception of time comes from our movement through space. And so when we're locked down and not moving anywhere, it does start to play strange games and tricks with our perception of the passage of time. And he's saying, you know, time has literally become quite personal and subjective rather than sort of centrally coordinated. And that creates this sort of glitch in the matrix type of feel. But what I really loved about the session was, and they were talking about the future of beautiful business, was their sort of principles of what the future might look like. And they were based around, you know, these new ideas of intimacy and how we can create that sense of intimacy online. And remove some of the initial barriers and filters that start to occur. How do we keep hold of this sense of playfulness? And also to surrender, to be able to, you know, abdicate this sense of control, which has been a recurrent theme for us through these talks. And I just loved the line at the end of it when they were saying, you know, only those who have let go with both hands are free.
Yes.
Yeah. And then the second thing was, a lovely piece from the Collective Psychology Project called This Too Shall Pass, Mourning Collective Loss in the Time of COVID-19. It's actually co-written by a mutual friend of ours, Casper Tekeil, and they've described this stuff as this world's biggest psychological experiment. And what I really valued in that report, sort of digging right into it, was this understanding of the power and the importance of ancestral wisdom to help us try and navigate, you know, the why of events, actually reveal some of the uncomfortable truths and then possible ways forward. And they've done a great job of exploring, as we've been trying to do, you know, three big themes around apocalypse, which is the unveiling piece that we've gone back to several times. The idea of restoration narratives, which are all about the rupturing and healing of the wound. And then emergence narratives and this birth of the new, and actually really digging into those three different elements and how they might help us see what is in front of us right now. And the bit that actually touched my heart was their 8 lessons about grief, We're just saying, you know, we're never going to get anywhere through any of this unless, you know, we're able to embrace this grief, you know, to acknowledge that it's probably going to get worse before it gets better, that we probably have much more collective grief to come, that it's not an equalizer, it's not felt evenly by people, and that actually our challenge, if you like, is to learn how to grieve together, to and to take insights and experience, hard-earned experience, from our ancestral knowledge and understanding, and then to develop the new rituals and practice to grapple with this idea that loss is natural, and that actually telling of stories is critical for helping us to find our way.
So all of this talk about storytelling and time and intimacy makes me think I have to give a plug here for something that's available to stream online until this Friday. Simon McBurney's theatre work, The Encounter, which is, you could say it's a one-man show, although McBurney would be the first to say that there is an extraordinary combination of collaborators who are not visible on the scene who make it possible. But it tells the story of this encounter that took place in the Amazon about 50 years ago. A National Geographic photographer who became hopelessly lost and was walking with this tribe whose language he didn't speak, they didn't speak his language. And he has this experience of being taken outside of time as he has ever known it before. And in the kind of weaving of this piece, McBurney talks to mathematicians and philosophers about time, as well as, you know, including conversations with his five-year-old daughter. And the whole thing, you experience it, even if you see it live in the theater, you are wearing headphones. I always think headphones are the ultimate technology of isolation. You know, you see someone wearing headphones, it's like a big fuck off sign saying, don't try and start a conversation with me. But what McBurney does in this kind of tricksterish way that the best of theatre making can do is to take this device of isolation and turn it into a device of intimacy. So if you've got a couple of hours one evening this week, I can't recommend it highly enough. Mm. We'll put the link in the show notes.
Have you ever put on a pair of noise-cancelling headphones?
No.
No. My friend Paul Dickinson, we were walking in Oxford Street earlier this year, and he said, try these. And I put them on. And obviously they just cancel all the ambient noise. And it's like walking through a movie of your own life. It's very, very strange and disorientating.
It sounds terrifying.
It is. It sort of is. It's suddenly, because everything else has disappeared. And it's like, yeah, it's like being in your own film.
So speaking of films and the terrifying and so on, I guess we sort of stumble into this territory of conspiracy and conspiracy theories. And we touched on this in the last episode, and I realized with various things that I've been reading in between then and now that I wanted to come back and dig in a little bit more. And maybe one place to start is, this was actually a Facebook post from Patrick Farnsworth, who has a great podcast called Last Born in the Wilderness. Like a lot of us, I think Patrick had seen many people, including people who might surprise you, posting links to some of the conspiracy theories that are doing the rounds about the pandemic. And he wrote this piece and he says, we're witnessing things fall apart as we speak. And the more you believe this is some deep state, one world government plot to force us all to get microchipped or vaccinated or whatever, the more it shows how in denial of this fact you really are. There's no fucking plan, at least not really. It's all crisis management to serve short-term profit motives in a socioeconomic system designed to expand infinitely. That program is reaching its logical limits on a planet that is finite. And much of what we are witnessing is a part of that reality. It requires a great deal of humility to see it for what it is. The most well-resourced institutions and individuals in this time are scrambling to manage these cascading changes for their own ends, and many of them are doing poorly at it, believe it or not. I imagine it's comforting in some way to believe this is under control, that there is a plan here, but there really isn't. And that's okay, because that's the way it's always been and always will be. It's our blindness and hubris that says otherwise. And to me, you know, that talk of humility, we're back at the heart of these conversations that we've been having. And it reminds me of a moment in early 2009, during that strange window after the financial crisis had begun the previous autumn, when, I mean, you may have experienced a version of this as well, Ed, but government departments in the UK were suddenly interested in talking to people whose emails they wouldn't have returned a year earlier if we had wanted to talk to them. And one of the strange meetings I found myself in was at the Foreign Office with David Miliband, who was Foreign Secretary at that point. And there were eight of us there. And he said, so the official purpose of this meeting is to talk about how we can help your businesses. And I was somehow one of the representatives of the UK's digital industries due to a mistake in someone's contact book, I think. And he said, but so I'd like to spend the first half of the meeting talking about that. And I'd like to spend the second half talking about how you can help us, because we know that the levers we use in foreign policy are broken. And we think you might have found some things with what you're doing with the internet that might help. And so in the second half of that meeting, he was trying to get us to brainstorm with him, like, how you could use social networks to connect ordinary people in Turkey to ordinary people in France and Germany so that the French and German governments might change their mind on Turkish accession to the EU, or how online trading might allow other economic opportunities than growing poppies for Afghan farmers. And I remember walking out of there and going, oh, right, some part of me thought there were grown-ups up there. But actually, it's just people fumbling around all the way to the top. And that's what I try and say to my conspiracy theory friends. And I'm not sure I convince them, but that's been my experience.
I think anyone who's had much dealings with the higher levels of authority tends to come away with a similar kind of experience. I've always preferred cock-up theory over conspiracy theory. I remember reading David Aronovich's Voodoo Histories about a decade or so ago. And in that, he rather eloquently argues that conspiracies are a kind of belief system. You know, they are sort of faith-based. And they're resilient precisely because they represent a sort of higher order of truth, one that doesn't need evidence. And in that book, he talks about, you know, some of the classics around 9/11 and the moon landings and the death of Princess Diana. But one of the key points he makes for me is that the sheer cost and implausibility of hundreds, if not thousands, of psychotically immoral co-conspirators, you know, in a system that leaks even the most mundane of insider politics and policies like a broken sieve. It's like, you know, we can't get through a week without, you know, the minutiae or the insider angle on most government policies being leaked to the press in some way, shape or form. And the one thing I would take issue with in Aronovich's book, and I think this is a lesson for today as well, as we're trying to heal wounds, is it's a bit nasty because he sort of beats up on the believer's delusions in a pretty scathing and demeaning fashion. And I think that's sort of counterproductive because at best that merely entrenches their beliefs or fuels their establishment narratives. And at worst, it creates even more extreme behavior and it cultivates a sort of nihilism that no one can be trusted, that democracy is a sham and everything's preordained by the orders of some malign or hidden source. And I think what's intriguing is that there's something behind a conspiracy that needs to be heard. There is that other voice. There is the anger, the fear, the disillusionment, or even the disenfranchisement. And ultimately, it's about a sense of meaning that really underpins the power of conspiracy. And I remember watching Beyond the Curve, the film about the US flat earth movement. I don't know if you've seen that. But if you can stem your own temptation to scoff, because it's, you know, there's a lot of pseudoscience in it and an almost sort of fantastical selectivity of data in order to try and prove, you know, that the earth is flat. But actually underneath that is a really quite oddly beautiful and very poignant story of the human need for belonging and recognition and respect in some way. And you actually find yourself deeply empathizing with the quirkiness of some of the key characters and the way that they nurture their own profiles within the movement. And it's actually rather touching, even if their beliefs were a bit bonkers, because you can see the connection and the camaraderie, and it's really quite lovely.
I mean, I don't want to go too condescending either in the way that we talk about this, because, you know, there's a lot before you get to the point where it all links together. Lots of the basic claims within conspiracy theories have a truth. And in fact, they tend to hold a truth that is unspeakable within the official narratives of the situation. So, you know, we are being lied to. There are very powerful forces that attempt to coordinate things at a global level and at levels below that. They do not have your best interests at heart. There is, amongst other things, an attempt to narrate the back to normal in such a way, or the new normal, in such a way as to make it inevitable, in such a way as to pretend that there is nothing desirable that lies outside of the frame. You know, there is no alternative. The basic mantra of neoliberalism, that's a conspiracy, right? So within conspiracy thinking, I see a lot that I can go along with. And then you get this kind of swerve, this moment where suddenly it all gets packaged together into one grand story. And that's, I guess, what I see Patrick reaching for in that passage that I read. I mean, this is a strange thought. And in a way, actually, a lot of conspiracy thinking is woven out of this kind of strangeness of dreamlike thinking too. But how about conspiracy theory is actually a toxic mimic for something that we badly need and aren't getting, which is conspiracy. And conspiracy, conspiratio, is literally breathing together. Now, you know, we can't breathe together right now. That's the thing that all of these measures are trying to prevent us doing. We are confronting a virus which manifests primarily in relation to our breathing. But even before this, you know, part of what we lack, part of the scarcity within the ways we've been living, the normal that we may not want to go back to, is the lack of that kind of deep lived sense of embodied being together. And, you know, we're going to talk later in this episode about Ivan Illich, who I've brought up at various points along through the series. And there's a text of his that's very beautiful. It's called The Cultivation of Conspiracy. And he basically says, you know, this is what I've been trying to do since I was young, together with my friends, is to create spaces, these kind of pockets, these little schools or counter institutions on the edge of the system, on the edge of big institutions, where it's possible for us to breathe together in an atmosphere that is so different to the sterility of the atmosphere that our institutions produce.
I think that that says to me that this is a moment to appreciate that actually we are probably just emerging from what's been a temporary bubble in human history. You know, this sort of weird period from the end of the Second World War to the early noughties, where we've had this relative consensus, if you were, and that, that comes with the caveat that you just described, you know, that actually we have been lied to, and actually our best interests are not always held at heart, and there is manipulation in the stories. But we have had this period where we've had a relatively stable mass broadcast media with broadly trusted sources, institutions, and that's obviously begun to like wildly fragment in recent years as the internet has become people's go-to source of information. And perhaps we're reverting to a way information has always been shared, which is that fragmentation, localism, quite a bit of gossip and misrepresentation. And in some sense, that goes straight back to, you know, reading that I was doing around Marshall McLuhan's work 20 years ago, when in the 60s, he was describing that, you know, the medium is the message in the classic expression, whereby, you know, you had television as a kind of broadcast from one to many, you know, relatively controlled. It was the way that you could disseminate a common cultural narrative. And it's fundamentally unsurprising in many ways that when you suddenly have the radicalism of the internet, where everyone can find their own particular bubble or furrow to plow, and we're all very highly selective about what we get, or if we're not being selective, we're being fed stuff based on our own mapped proclivities and tastes. And so McLuhan's sense that you know, the medium is the message. It's unsurprising that we've split and we're not breathing together. You know, we're all actually taking short gasps for breath in our own little isolated pockets.
Well, this is the thing. The, you know, the mass broadcast media that McLuhan was talking about, you know, obviously we've been telling stories for 20 years or more about how the internet is disrupting and transforming that. And I feel like I traveled through an era in which those stories were told in a utopian key into an era in which they've been told in a dystopian key. And I find much to sympathize with in actually both of those ways of telling. And part of the complexity of it is that, you know, the mass broadcast medium was not a breathing together. It absolutely wasn't. I mean, I'm remembering, as I say this, a musicologist who I met at a festival in Estonia a couple of years ago, who was talking about collecting these songs in villages from these very old women. And she said, you know, we realize that there's kind of two eras of these, of this music. There's the really old material, and then there's the material that comes from once radio arrived. Because once radio arrived, all of the rhythms become standardized to these very international ways of playing music, because that's what people are hearing. Before that, you have this real radical, wild diversity of the older folk tradition. And, you know, Illich would say, I mean, he told a story about how as a baby, he was brought to his grandfather's house on this island off the coast of Croatia. And on the same ferry that brought him came the first loudspeakers that ever came to that island. And he would say, you know, we take it almost for granted now that most of the words that any of us hear in our lives are spoken by people who will never know that we exist. And that is a huge transformation of human experience and human existence from the ways, the many different ways in which people have made life work in many different times and places up to that point in, you know, when our grandparents were born pretty much in the 1920s. So in noting the alarming things about the breakdown of the mass media system, it's important for me, I guess, not to romanticize that system, nor to romanticize, obviously, what, you know, what it displaced. It's all just so much more complex than that. And one piece that I read in the last couple of weeks that captures some of this complexity, actually, is David Fuller, who's the founder of Rebel Wisdom, which is a kind of YouTube channel and platform. Very interesting guy, very interesting project. And David spent like 20 years working in the industry that I spent a few years working in. So he was really deep in the BBC and then Channel 4, working in newsrooms as a documentary maker. And then he's gone over to this kind of new media as somebody who is quite critical of the failings of the institutions that he had been part of. He's been doing an investigation into this London Real interview with David Icke and all of the shenanigans around that. And he talks very well about both the brokenness of the traditional media, its failure as a sense-making and truth-seeking enterprise, and the failure of the new platforms to even like figure out how to take on that role of sense-making and truth-seeking and gatekeeping. But when I was reading David's piece about this, I found myself wondering, you know, why should we assume that there is a good answer to this that works at the scale of either broadcast media or the internet, which is a new anarchic form of broadcast media entangled with all sorts of other things? You know, it may just be that the only scale at which we have a hope of doing sense making and truth seeking is the small scale. Illich would say the limit of political possibility today is the number of people who can sit around a table and share a meal together. Obviously, that number is lower for many of us right now than it would ordinarily be. But maybe part of the regrowing that's called for involves that scale of coming together to make sense of things.
I mean, I was speaking to my mum the other day, who was obviously, like many people in their 70s, probably digesting far more conventional and traditional news than is probably healthy. And my mum's description of her situation was, she goes, "I'm stuck here in this hellhole." And I had to sort of point quite politely and gently remind her that she was at home, you know, in the country, in a nice house with her new puppy, you know, well fed and watered. And it just struck me that, you know, it was part of this sort of catastrophizing of partly of age, but also the catastrophizing that you get into if you do, you know, read too much Daily Mail or listen to Piers Morgan on This Morning. And I think that's definitely a generational factor.
Well, catastrophizing just seems to be the drumbeat. It's the tone that news knows how to do. I remember reading years and years ago PJ O'Rourke's book Holidays in Hell about his experiences as a thoroughly disreputable foreign correspondent going to war zones. And he says something at the beginning where he's like, you know, that tone that the foreign correspondent puts on that tells you how serious and important what they're about to tell you is, why do we need that? Because if what they're going to tell you is serious and important, it doesn't need to be said in that tone. And if it isn't, why is it being said in that tone? But when you mention the conversations with your mum, this kind of brings me back around to something I wanted to talk about this week, because it feels like a long time now since we were starting these conversations in the middle of March. And I guess all of us will have particular memories of the moment, you know, the days, the week in early March when the world slid sideways and it suddenly became clear that this coronavirus thing wasn't just something you were kind of seeing out of the corner of your eye, wasn't just another news story. It was coming as a disruptive force on so many levels into pretty much all of our lives, directly or indirectly. And you know, I remember various conversations that week with friends where we were talking about the conversations we were having with our parents. And the thing that emerged from this was a concern that, let's say, our parents' generation in their 70s or so were not taking this pandemic as seriously as we thought they ought to be taking it. And some of that is just to do with the difference between our patterns of news consumption, and that, you know, you and I and many people of our generation can, you know, get mobilized and start changing our plans and trying to persuade our parents to change their plans on the basis of a convincing seeming Medium post about the exponential spread of a viral pandemic, while our parents' generation might not be willing to act on that basis without hearing something from figures of authority and more authoritative sources of news, such as they are. So that may have been part of what was going on. But what struck me as I found myself having the same discussion about this with various different friends who were all around the same age was part of what's going on, or like, this is my suspicion, part of what is going on had to do with the difference between how death sounds to us and to our parents. Because if you have reached the age of 70, then the chances are you have come to live with the social reality of death and your own mortality. You've seen people you've known all your life buried. You know, you've seen what it is like to go like further on beyond where you are into the real territory of old age, where so much falls away and falls apart. So you may no longer have the unqualified desire to live another 10 or 20 years that you had 10 or 20 years ago. You know, it becomes conditional. It becomes very much dependent on whether you have your health. You know, gradually it becomes more and more about your desire to see a little bit more of the story of the young ones, knowing that you're not going to see the whole of their stories because you will be gone before their stories are over, all being well. And so in the end, what I found myself saying in conversation with my parents was, look, you know, this isn't about the possibility that you might die. Actually, you know, if we're honest, we all live with that possibility. And especially at your age, you live with that possibility that in any given year, there's a non-trivial chance that you might die this year. But it's about you dying alone in hospital, unvisited, having to say goodbye over a screen, being cremated without a funeral.
I totally hear that. I had the exact same conversation with my 65-year-old neighbour yesterday, actually. And, you know, he's got a heart condition, chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder and diabetes. And he was out there smoking a joint on his balcony. And I was tending my tomato plants. And as he said, he goes, I'm obviously high risk. He goes, I don't mind going, but I certainly don't want to go like that.
Right. You know, in a way, what happened then was that the world did slide sideways. We got locked down. Even in Sweden, actually, the over 70s were told quite firmly by the government to, stay home, get someone else to do your shopping, don't go on public transport. So those, like, the conversation across the generations became shortcutted by the official measures that were taken. But I found myself going back to those conversations in early March because I think that they reveal something about the heart of this crisis that is not brought clearly into view by the reporting of the escalating death tolls. And to make sense of this, I need to say a little bit more about this guy, Ivan Illich, who I keep coming back to. And in particular, this set of short books that he wrote during the 70s, where he sketched out a kind of a critique of the institutions of modern industrial society that was not based on any romantic longing to go back to anything else, but was attempting to frame a set of choices that we needed to make that were not revealed by the ordinary political narratives or scales of left and right and so on. And one of his core claims was that modern industrial society was producing a new kind of human being, people who are helpless in a way that was previously unthinkable because of our total dependency throughout our lives on professionally delivered services and the atrophication of our capacity to meet our own needs and those of people around us. A little story that captures what that looks like. Martin Prechtel, who's a curious character, an extraordinary teacher, his stories have a kind of wild trickster character to them, but this one also has a ring of practical, everyday, grounded truth to it. He is arriving in the early 1970s in a village in Guatemala, a Mayan village, so not so different to the Mayan villages in Mexico that Illich knew well and was writing from the experience of. Prechtel wants to stay in this community. It's a large village. It's got a population of about 20,000 people. And he's going around trying to find people who speak Spanish who might help him find somewhere to stay. And he gets into all of these hilarious dead-end conversations where they just can't understand what it is he's asking for. And they're like, but wait a minute, you're telling me you want to give me money to live on your own in a house without any family, without any elders, without any children, without any women? Why would you want to do that? Where are the people whose house it is going to live? And then they're like, well, but okay, why don't you just build a house? And he's like, well, I don't know how to build a house. And well, why don't you get your father and your mother and your uncles to help you build a house? It's like, well, I don't really have a father and mother and uncles. And then they're like, you're an orphan. And they finally found a category to describe somebody this helpless. And so that thing that, in all of these different ways, a new scarcity is created as we move from a world in which the ability to build a house is something which you and or the people immediately around you in your family and community have, to something where you have a right to be housed, let's say, but those houses have to be built to specifications that are determined from above by some combination of the interests of the building industry and the state's desire to set standards. And in all of these different areas of our lives, you create a new scarcity, a dependence on professionally delivered services, where that supply of those services is limited by the availability of accredited professionals, whilst the capacity that you once had, whether it's to build a house or whether it's to be responsible for the learning of the children and young people within your community, or whether it's to care for people at the time of their dying, you know, those skills are lost by the production of this new kind of society. And that's part of what Illich was inviting us to notice.
I mean, I very much saw that resilience and self-reliance when I was teaching in Jamaica, where obviously there were families in the village where I worked who were living in houses that were self-built from local bamboo. And I remember in Mongolia, you know, the traditional nomads there were still building their own yurts. So as you say, they were equipped with the skills and the resources and the ability to be able to be self-sufficient.
Right. And so those of us who score highest on the indicators of development often look to the perspective of people who still have one foot within a traditional culture, you know, both, yes, privileged, but actually helpless, like orphan children. And this was, you know, this was the story that Illich, coming out of this Center for Intercultural Documentation that he had co-founded in Mexico in the early 60s, he was telling this story about how the world looks when it's not seen through the lens of those who usually write the textbooks on international development and so on. And he was telling it in this moment of this kind of crisis of the 1970s, this real kind of crisis of confidence when the post-war decades of shared rising prosperity in the Western countries had come to an end. America was mired in a horrible war in Vietnam. The civil rights movement had ended in huge disillusionment, as well as certain limited achievements, and so on and so forth. It's hard to imagine the status that Illich had for a while in those years. But one example of it, he came to give a lecture in Edinburgh, I think this was 1974, and they had to book out every lecture theatre in the university and run an audio relay because they had over 3,000 people turn up to hear him give this talk. And one of the people who was there that night was a medical student called Richard Smith, who listened to Illich talk about this thing that he called medical nemesis, the counterproductivity of highly industrialized medical systems. And Smith actually quit medical school after hearing that talk. 3 days later, he dropped back in because he didn't know what else to do with his life. And he ended up as the editor of the British Medical Journal. And you can find things that he has written over the years about the influence of Illich's critique and his thinking on the conversations that he and others within the medical profession had from the 70s onwards and its continuing relevance. But one of the points that Illich makes in the book of Medical Nemesis is about this loss of the capacity for dying.
Mm. Yeah, and you said that, didn't you? Because we don't handle that well. You know, like the examples you were just giving from Guatemala and Mexico and actually the reference to your parents earlier. I mean, I was struck by the sort of tragic death last week, amongst many, of one of the UK's conscious hip hop pioneers, Ty. He and I were the same age. You know, I made a film with him once, shooting an interview on the roof of my block of flats. And in some ways, he's the first person I know to have died of coronavirus. And it came as a bit of a shock. Although I immediately reflected, you know, on his own truths and achievements as a sort of genuine community player. He was very authentic and very outspoken values. And as a 20-year resident of Brixton, I still love his line, you know, we no longer hold the Atlas dear here, about our multicultural neighbourhood, which I think is still quite a beautiful line. And as his fellow local lad, Rodney Smith, a.k.a. Roots Maneuver, said by way of pithy obituary, RIP, Ty, you did a good job. And he certainly didn't, like so many, deserve to die alone on the ward. You know, he'd actually come through the virus itself and was sadly finished off, killed by the secondary pneumonia. And I think, you know, that is it's the classic encapsulation of it's no way to die.
No. And I think as we try and have this conversation, it's incredibly important to keep it connected to those personal experiences of the ways in which this is touching so many of our lives. and to try and follow the threads that lead from the questions Illich was asking over 40 years ago into the heart of this pandemic that we're in the middle of and the way that it is playing out in our societies, the risk is that we end up with this kind of view from 30,000 feet looking down. And there's a lovely passage in one of John Berger's books where he says we need to be able to make maps that, yes, see the world from 30,000 feet, but with every heart drawn on a one-to-one scale. And to me, that's, you know, in all of this thinking together and telling of stories and sharing of ideas, that is a principle to steer by. And there's a story that the anthropologist Hugh Brody tells from the end of the 1970s, where he arrives back in the town in northeastern British Columbia, where he has been living and working for the best part of 2 years with this Dinitsar indigenous community, helping to document their ways of living with and on the land as part of a negotiation with the authorities. And he finds that a good friend of his, whose household he had lived in, is in hospital and goes to see him there. And this man is in his 80s. And so Brody goes to the doctor and says, you know, how's he doing? And the doctor says, well, you know, there's not much we can do. His lungs are shot. And there's almost a kind of callousness as Brody hears it to the straightforwardness of this. But he goes to the ward and he finds his friend. And his friend is dressed with his bag next to him, ready to go. And he says, shall we go now? And Brody's like, well, yeah, I mean, the doctors said you can go, but I suppose you could stay here if you wanted to. And his friend, Thomas Hunter, that's his name. Thomas wants to go to the dry meat camp, which is away north from, a few miles north from the reservation. And again, Brody sort of says, well, maybe you'd be better on the reservation where there's a clinic where the nurse comes once a week and there's a telephone that you can use if somebody needs to call the hospital. He says, no, I want to go to the dry meat camp. That's where my family are at this time of year. And he gets there. There's nobody there. And again, Brody has one last attempt at trying to persuade him to go back to the reservation, at least to find someone from his family. But he says, no, better to end here. And he sits down and Brody makes sure that he's got a fire going and a pot of tea brewing. And then he says goodbye to his friend. And a few weeks later, he hears that he's died. And within that, within the holding frame of their friendship, you see these two different attitudes to dying. And two other social scientists, Barney Glaser and Anselm Strauss, in the 1960s published a famous book called Awareness of Dying, based on 6 years of research they'd done in North American hospitals, looking at the conversations that go on around death. And one of the things that they noticed was that there were kind of two different groups of people. There was one group where, once it became clear that there was no forward path of treatment, the family wanted to get the person back from the hospital to the home as quickly as possible so that they could die on their own terms. And there was another group, and the historian Philip Arrier, writing about this, glosses them as these are the ones who are more deeply involved with modernity, who are coming to hospital in order to die, because the home is no longer a place in which dying can happen for either cultural or practical reasons. You know, it's a story that includes everything from the increased prevalence of central heating within homes to how long people wait now between when someone's died and when there's a funeral, so that it's no longer practical to have them laying out in the front room of the cottage in the way that would have been the case in many working class communities in England through well into the 20th century. But the upshot of this is that we live in societies where it is hard to die without going to hospital unless you do it in a hurry. And yes, we have palliative care for those who are dying slowly, but that's another form of dependence on professional resources. I've talked before about how weird it was at the beginning of April when everyone in England was in lockdown, that we were actually moving house here in Sweden because things were kind of different here. But my Syrian friend Roni was helping us move, and we were talking about the virus and everything. And I was saying to him, you know, I think that part of the story here is about hospitals and about our need to die in hospital. And he said, you know, I come from a different culture, but where I come from, it's a shame. It's a matter of shame for us if our old people die in hospital. To die in your own bed is a saying. It's a thing that you want to do. And so I guess this is the nub of what I've been trying to draw out from Illich. When it becomes necessary for practical as well as cultural reasons to go to hospital in order to die, then if you have an unusual season of dying, which is it's one way we could describe what we're living through at the moment, it's not just a human tragedy for every family who's affected. It's also a systemic threat to the viability of the whole society in a way that, you know, has not been the case until the creation of these dependencies and this, the kind of hidden scarcity that accompanies the dependence on modern professional services, which is what Illich was trying to tell us about in the 70s. So, I mean, actually, look, it's back to your Martin Rees quote that you had, Ed, the other week about, you know, medieval villages that were able to cope, to use a modern word, to keep going and to survive a Black Death plague that had a 50% mortality rate in many places, and a modern high-tech society which is in real danger of collapse and an out-of-control collapse with a disease that has a 1% mortality.
Yeah, we all need the bigger picture perspective of a national treasure in the form of the cosmological view of the Astronomer Royal. He's quite a man, is Sir Martin Rees. He's also the co-founder of the Centre for Existential Risk. So we should perhaps listen a little more closely to some of his lifetime of wisdom that he tends to share. And he also wrote his book, Our Final Hour, way back in 2003. So a voice from the margins that perhaps should be a little bit more central to some of these conversations.
Yes. So where I've been reaching towards here is that what we saw in March at that moment where the world slid sideways is that it dawned on politicians across Europe and elsewhere that the stability of their societies was in jeopardy. Because if you get hospitals overwhelmed to the point where they cannot operate, then the number of people dying from the virus itself is multiplied several times by the number of people dying for other reasons where they probably wouldn't have died if the hospital had been able to provide its usual level of care to them. And so the willingness to take extraordinary measures with extraordinary economic consequences is because at some level, the politicians realized that no modern government can survive the collapse of its healthcare system. Mm. That it would be a disaster so great that it could undermine the legitimacy of the political and economic system as a whole. I mean, I was talking to Jay Springett last week for his podcast, and he said, I think what we've seen is the destruction of the economy in order to save capitalism. Because, you know, the economic benefits of not having lockdown in many countries would be a moot point given the level of social breakdown that we would have got to if you had the NHS actually collapsing and unable to provide many of its basic services. So there's a read on this whole situation in which we've got a double bind of a kind that is full of the echoes of these warnings that Illich was making in the 1970s, where there may be, you know, in some ways, there is no good choice that doesn't involve going through some form of falling apart, going through some form of passing through a traumatic crisis. But I think it's worth going back and, you know, rereading what people like Illich were trying to say as a way to help us find our bearings.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point, Dougal, because I think most people assume a double bind is just a no-win situation where you're trying to juggle two competing and conflicting challenges. You know, in this case, saving lives versus saving the economy. You know, it reminds me of the Vietnam War, where the general said, you know, we had to, in order to destroy the village, or in order to save the village, we had to destroy it. It's that sort of double bind. But, you know, and especially in this sense, when saving the economy may also mean saving lives in the short term, but then costing them in the long term. And I think that's the really true nature of a genuine double bind, where it's actually, it's hard to define the paradoxical situation in which the decisions must be made. Or for example, when an instruction is made by an authority that must be followed, yet is inherently contradictory. So people are left with a situation going, I must do it, but I can't do it. And I think we've totally seen that this week with the UK government shift from their mantra of stay at home, save lives, protect the NHS, to stay alert, control the virus, save lives, which has basically unleashed a double bind on the whole population. It's almost impossible and fundamentally exhausting to stay alert, you know. We're certainly not in control. And this sort of change in messaging then triggered a pandemic of viral memes mocking its sort of muddled incoherence, some of which were like, you know, be vague, cover our backs, shirk responsibility, or back to work, catch the virus, save the billionaires being among the most popular. But my old friend John Alexander of the New Citizenship Project summed it up really well in a blog that also then rapidly gained 500,000 reads. Because what John describes in terms of the messaging shift was this movement from the virus's description as an invisible mugger, you know, from which we as victims must be defended by the heroic, strong arm, all-knowing government, which is what John calls the subject story. And obviously that quickly fell apart as it became clear that it was the government that was weak, that wasn't being led by science, as they claimed, and it was people who are actually powerful through mutual aid, playing back to your points about resilience and self-reliance in Guatemala. And the new messaging almost heralded what John calls the consumer story, where government gets out of the way, where COVID-19 is a barrier or an inconvenience or a hindrance to people getting back to normal in their lives, and that personal responsibility is key. And if you get the virus, it's your fault for not being alert enough. And John's proposed response to that is a citizen story, where we're all actually in the same boat and we have to work together to not defeat or control the virus, but to adapt to this new reality with honesty and transparency.
Yeah. And part of that is noticing together what has been revealed by this crisis, going back to that language of apocalyptic revealing that you talked about in the first episode. And there's one other thing that I read this week that really embodied that for me, which is this short piece on Medium from Christos Galanis, talking about how this pandemic is revealing something about our culture's story of what health is. It seems to me, Christos writes, that our culture's story of what health is something like a mathematical formula that is applied to every context and situation. And by plugging in all the relevant variables, what you want to get is the maximum number of humans staying alive for the maximum amount of time. What does it mean that our culture equates health with every human being alive, staying alive for the maximum duration of time that our technologies are capable of squeezing out, and that we direct untold amounts of time, energy, treasure, education, and non-human lives towards perpetually improving those technologies? Consider that the root of the word health is cognate with the word whole. To be healthy means to be whole. Your ancestors once knew this. Consider how it came to be that this was forgotten. And maybe that's the kind of prophetic voice that Illich was offering in the 70s, saying difficult things to us, that somebody like Christos is offering at this moment.
Yeah, and I think that actually brings us back to the cultivating conspiracy theme, in a sense, you know, about the importance of this language and the way that we frame it. My friend Emily Stewart wrote a nice piece on LinkedIn, following on from the government's messaging change, saying it would have been much more interesting to suggest that people stay aware, not stay alert, you know, rather than this sort of heightened fear sense. She said she had not had a single conversation in the last 2 months that it included the word alert. But she'd heard numerous references to acceptance, to trust, to courage, to integrity, to practice, to tenderness, to curiosity, to surrender. Or that was the narrative and the language she was hearing from the real conversations with real people, not the stuff that was coming in this top-down way, and very much playing to that sense of wholeness. And that echoes what John Alexander was saying about this worrying shifting responsibility to the individual, this prodding of fear, you know, you've got to stay alert. And then adding a false roadmap to an exit and a pretense of control into the mix is very disorientating, and perhaps deliberately so for people. And Emily's point was that the language of this matters really, really acutely. And as is so often the way, and as you so beautifully did at the beginning when you took us back to the root of conspiracy to breathe together. And I then went back to information, which is literally information. What is conveyed by a particular arrangement of things or sequence of things? And as you said, you know, the best conspiracies have some factual elements or play to actually a valid worldview, but then often distort or elaborate or confuse correlation with causality. And I think my concern is that conspiracies are not blameless or victimless. You know, we see a large gathering of anti-lockdown protesters in Hyde Park this weekend, and Trump's not so tacit encouragement of armed lockdown libertarians in Michigan and other states. And those are the manifestations of conspiracy, which are very dangerous and worrying, I think, in these strange times. And the other word I went back to is the word intention. And intention obviously means your purpose or your aim, but it also has a meaning which is literally to heal the wound. And literally, this comes back to what I was saying right at the start about restoration narratives and restoration myths to heal those wounds and those ruptures. And in that sense, intention matters. And it would be a terrible irony if in seeking a common breath together, we were suffocated by that misinformation. And in seeking simple but wrong solutions, we didn't heal, but rather reopened wounds. And in seeking to prolong life, we missed its true purpose.
Thank you for listening to The Great Humbling. These are astonishing times to be living in, times in which many things are revealed, uncovered, brought into a new light. We see this podcast as very much an exploration, not a prescription, a provisional investigation that maybe loves questions more than answers to begin with, and needs a little time and space to breathe. This is an unscripted conversation, a wandering, if you will. And as Tolkien said, not all those who wander are lost. We plan this as a series of informal and roving conversations as we all adventure into uncharted internal and external territories. For us, daring to dream beyond the current urgency does not dismiss or disrespect it. Rather, it honours it. Whether we like it or not, our futures are already being decided today. Please do comment, ask questions and respond. You can find us on Facebook at The Great Humbling. This is initiation at a cultural scale. Please come and join us on this emergent journey.